The following presentation was recorded at a teacher's workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
The last bell rang. The building filled with shouts and cheers and emptied soon. Yet one still sat. He looked at me and I could see in the thin face an awful realization no other child had known. The year was gone. I knew, but I was older. I could bear the lost and sickish feeling of farewell from simple familiarity with it. I went back to where he sat. I said there would be other years. I said that I would write him letters in the summer. Somehow he knew, this child who had never had a letter in his life, that warm words are always somehow cold on paper, and never take the place of being close. Slowly, he gathered up his books. Walking toward the door, he looked around the room. What did he see? What had this been to him? I knew, and yet I could not know. It was the end of a year. Just some musings of a teacher. At the end of a year. As I read that and contemplate the picture I've seen many times, both in my own childhood and in my teaching, you know, the last day, and knowing how the school seems as it clears out for the last time, I ask myself, what is this whole business we call education? What are we setting out to accomplish? Are we doing it right? Who's to say? And how did we get to where we are today? Well, there are some things we can learn about where we are today. I'd like to have us look at a couple of things. May be apparent and related at first, but I think you'll see the connection. This is Marcy. This is it, Marcy. A new school year, in what I like to call the excitement of learning. It's an adventure that everyone can enjoy. I mean, after all, isn't that what life is all about? Yes, Marcy, this is it. That wasn't too bad. The excitement of learning lasted 14 seconds. Student, rather nonplussed, standing beside his desk. I was trying so hard to look as if I were paying attention that I didn't hear what you said. I love his face. You can just see shock and amazement. Those excerpts. What's Christian about that statement? Anyone? Well, what's right? Anything right about that statement? You all see it?
We're trying to prepare young lives to be.
Okay.
We're not seeing the end of it in our part.
So, I think you referred to this last part. You would agree that education is not preparation for life. Education is life itself. And you would say that, you said you were preparing students
for
something later on. So, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that what you do today in the classroom is actually real life. Anyone else? Is
vegetation grow? Yes, it is. There's something good about that. Are there some social processes in education? Relationships? How about it? Are you training people for some, is what you are teaching your students relevant and alive for today, or is it something you're trying to do for some later date? Could it be both once in a while? Look who wrote that. Maybe you don't know him, but we'll talk about him today. He's not a Christian, by the way. He was not. Another statement of his, and I think it's quite accurate. The teacher must keep alive the spark of wonder to prevent it from becoming blasé, from overexcitement, wooden, from routine, fossilized through dogmatic instruction, to the level of that spark of wonder, or dissipated through random exercise upon trivial things.
Someone has said that the reason we study history, we study it because in order to know where we are, we must know where we have been. I thought at first we had a pretty thin crowd tonight. It's still a little bit thin. And maybe that's a commentary on how much we like history. I commented someone today that my title sounds a little cold and academic. But I'd like to show you tonight that what I have to say really does shed some light on what you're doing in the classroom. How many of you teach in individualized settings, classrooms? Okay. How many of you lecture conventional type, traditional classrooms? Okay. Well, tonight I want to paint a picture of where we've been, how we got to where we are. But I'm going to admit right up front, it's going to be some pretty broad general strokes. We don't have time to do everything we'd like to do. But I want to begin with some historical foundations, just very quickly, and then spend more time on some philosophical roots, and then spend a little bit of time on the practical implications and results, what it looks like. Well, we're limiting our discussion really to the 20th century, as the title says. You know, we could go back to ancient Greece and Rome and talk about what they did in education. We could go back even further to Jewish practices. We could talk about early Christian education. We could talk about the Middle Ages, and sometimes known as the Dark Ages. We could talk about the time of the Renaissance, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, where a man-centered view of the world began to take shape in learning and a renewed interest in the arts and humanities. And then, of course, as the song we sang tonight, Martin Luther in 1517 nailed his thesis to the door and sparked what we now know as the Reformation. And then we have the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, and we have the great awakenings of the Wesleys and the Whitfield. And then, of course, we have 19th century figures such as Edmund Burke, Darwin, Hegel, Marx, and others who very much are alive in terms of their ideas today. It helps, I think, and this was new for me, but it helps if you remember that from the years of 1500 to 1900, which brings us up to the 20th century, there were two streams of thought that were in tension between each other. Number one was religious reformation, and number two, we have scientific revolution. Those two things are in tension. Now look at the results of science today. incredible, whether it's computers, medicine, the car you drive, the phones you use, faxes, I mean, you name it, science has brought that about, in specific terms at least. And then we have the religious reformation that happened, as I said, around 1500, and the powerful influences that has had, and the ebb and flow as you read church history, and the impact that Christianity had on education and society as a whole. Well, I want to look then, bringing us up closer to the 20th century. I'll look at three men. The first one being Thomas Jefferson, born in 1743, died in 1826. This man, we all know his name as the author of the Declaration of Independence. But he was a brilliant thinker. He loved to read, loved to learn, read voraciously in Italian, French, Greek, Hebrew, and would read the classics in the original languages, read it up to his old age. I can't imagine being able to read voraciously in those languages. But he did. And he had a remarkable capacity for work and study. And very young, entered into the public arena and was, as I said, author of the Declaration. He was a member of the Continental Congress. He was governor of Virginia, ambassador to France, secretary of state, vice president, and finally president of the United States. Quite a resume. But pertinent to our discussion tonight, we want to look at a bill he introduced when he was governor of Virginia in 1779. It was called the Bill for the More General Diffusion of Knowledge. And in it, he put forth three things. He said, number one, that a Republican government and democratic citizenry requires an educated and literate citizenry. Okay? We must be able to read, and you must be educated. Secondly, he said that education should be a political rather than a religious function. See the change from what was. He wanted to shift it from religious to political. And then thirdly, he said education should be vested in state government. Shouldn't be too centralized in federal government. Should be vested in state government. Well, he introduced that as governor in 1779 and again was introduced in 1817, I believe. Neither time did it pass, but it showed the direction of thought during that time in education. And he was a forerunner of state-supported elementary schools. It's interesting to note that as much as we see danger in his statements, that Jefferson personally, although not perhaps devoutly Christian, still read his Bible. Often he was a man of very high morals. In fact, he said one time that of morals and health and, I believe, education, he said that give them all up, fame, money, health, wealth, all of them, rather than do an immoral act. So he held the character of very high esteem, but we begin to see a shift in thought. And I don't believe Jefferson foresaw the conclusions of his thinking, as we can see looking back. Second person I'd like to look at is Horace Mann. At the age of 14, it's interesting, I think, to understand Horace Mann. At the age of 14, his 17-year-old brother died. And at the funeral, the family pastor, who was a devout man, he was Calvinist by persuasion, but some writers call him austere and stern, others kind and genial, so we're not sure what kind of man he was. But at the very least, he was very firm in his belief in what the role that God played in people coming to know him. And he said over the pulpit at that funeral that this boy, the 7-year-old boy in the casket, was most assuredly in hell because he had never given his life to God. And Horace Mann said that he never forgot the groans of his mother at that funeral after that statement. And although he did not completely forsake Christianity per se, he did leave that church, became a Unitarian, although it's not Unitarian as we know Unitarianism today. He believed in God as creator, among other things, the importance of morality. But he did not believe Christianly as you and I would today. His great passion, however, was universal education. That was the passion of his day. Now notice, he was born in 1796. His life overlapped somewhat with Jefferson. He died in 1858. But notice some of the things he accomplished and stood for. He envisioned the school as an agency that could change society and bring in a utopian state. Okay, he championed emancipation of blacks. He championed help for handicapped. One of the reasons he did is because he said, look at me. He said, I started out as a poor boy and I achieved fame and fortune through education. And so he wanted that for everyone. So he championed it for blacks, for handicapped people, for women. When he assumed the presidency of Antioch College in 1852, he immediately opened the doors to blacks, all religious sects, and also to women on the same basis as men. That was a radical idea in 1852. But those things he stood for, he opened the first public normal school, which was a school for training teachers. And a lot of other things. He campaigned against prison conditions, a lot of social issues that he was very concerned about. But he also found the Massachusetts Board of Public Education in 1839 and again set the foundation for public education. And he felt it should be. He essentially defined salvation, Christian salvation, as freedom, and education took the place of morality. Well, Horace Mann died in 1858. In 1859, a man by the name of John Dewey was born, and he lived until 1952. And that's important, I believe, in understanding his life and the directions his philosophy took. Think about all that happened between 1859 and 1952. That brings us almost up to where we are. Maybe I'm revealing myself, at least a few of us in this room. But think about it. He probably remembered the last days of the Civil War. He lived through World Wars I and II and up into the 1950s. He saw the Industrial Revolution. He saw the first cars and planes and jets. Incredible what he saw in his lifetime. A tremendous time to be alive. Incredible change. Although they say now that you and I are witnessing change on a much more rapid pace than what he did. But in terms of being visible and affecting lifestyle, it was very radical. But he espoused a philosophy known as progressivism. He called it instrumentalism. It's also known as pragmatism. You know, if someone says, I'm very pragmatic, that means whatever works, all right? Whatever works is what I like to do. Hey, I don't really care about what you think about it or what you believe about that. If it works, fine. It's good enough for me, all right? That's pragmatism in a very rough definition. But he liked the word instrumentalism because he wanted to use whatever was instrumental and useful. Dewey views nature as being in flux, a constant state of flux. He probably wouldn't have used the word constant because nothing was constant in his mind. He saw it as ever-changing. Therefore, knowledge must continually be redefined and rediscovered. Now think about that. Knowledge, what you know, what you say is true, must be continually redefined and rediscovered. Now, what does that mean when you apply it to education? Well, Dewey believed that natural science is forced by its own development to abandon any notion of fixity or absolutes. Just restating again what he said earlier. He believed that man could do away with poverty, disease, and many evils that we thought were inevitable if we just used our minds, our intelligence, and science. Does it begin to sound familiar? He believed that an idea or concept is not true because it properly discloses reality. In other words, if you state an idea, it's not necessarily true just because it discloses reality. But because it serves an organism, whether it's you or another animal on the earth, but because it serves an organism in a useful way to allow it to adapt to its environment. Okay, so let's use an example. He says that H2O is not water, but rather it describes a plan of action by which we utilize water for satisfactory purposes. Okay, now that's a little over your head, it's over mine too. But Gordon Clark explains it this way. He said, most of us, of course, would say that science is valuable in producing usable items. We use it all the time. Medicine, computers. But the question that Dewey did not answer is, can it furnish any reason for choosing this one in preference to that one? You begin to see where that could lead. If usable purposes is my only reason for choosing something, then I can use medicine as Hitler did, and I can use people for scientific experiments, inject dye into their eyes and see what happens, you know, those kinds of things. Science doesn't furnish any reason for choosing one in preference to another. Now, think about the change again that Dewey was witnessing all around him. Incredible change. Change had not taken place in the history of the world. How many centuries had men used horses and animals for transportation? Suddenly, they were being outmoded, outdated. Just one example. You ever get to the Museum of Science, Air and Space Museum in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., you get a chance to, and maybe you've seen the one IMAX on the history of flight. I can't remember the exact name of it. But it shows a little bit of that tremendous change that took place over that time. Well, Dewey had a tremendous influence on American education. And we are still seeing the influence that he had to this very day. And I'd like to look now at some other philosophies that developed following Dewey, and especially in the 20s and 30s, Dewey's philosophy really took hold. And there were a lot of excesses that took place that Dewey was radically opposed to. He said, this is not what I had in mind, but it was the logical outworking of his philosophy. But remember again the quote that I showed you earlier. Some things that he said, I believe, have merit and were right. And I think we do well to keep in mind the statement that all truth is God's truth, whether we find it in the pagan philosopher or whether we find it in Scripture. Anywhere we find truth, it's God's truth. I'd like to look now at a few things that followed.
One philosophy that I'm guessing a lot of us could find some common ground in that was around before Dewey began espousing his philosophy was perennialism. And perennialism had the idea that some things never change. For instance, the nature of human beings never changes. That there is some objective truth and that we ought to be passing that truth on to the next generation. Some things are constant. Well, Dewey came along and talked about progressivism, and his key word was experiencing, doing. He wanted to change, rather than the teacher forcing what they thought on the student, he wanted the student to be able to explore what he thought was interesting. And he wanted to exercise the student's mind and engage it, spark some interest, and like the quote I showed you earlier, keep that interest going. Keep it sparked and not pour cold water on it by handing out vocabulary lists and putting big written tests in front of the student. You want to keep the student learning. involved. He thought the classroom should be the laboratory of society. So from teachers that espouse this, they would have their class set up in orderly society. And they would have rules and leaders, and class would decide what the rules would be, what the leaders should be, and how to make things work in the classroom, to train them for society. Because what happened, what we know in the past is no longer important. All the change, remember, knowledge had to be constantly redefined and rediscovered. So everything that was in the past, the great artists, the great writers, all the historical things, what did that matter? That happened then, this is now. Why study it? It's always going to be changing. Nothing is constant. That was due. Well, as the excesses came into, became more and more apparent, people began, they stopped grading people. What good is a grade? Knowledge changes all the time, so how well you know what we're telling you now isn't all that important, because what you learn tomorrow and the next day is probably more important than what you're learning today anyway. So what good is a grade? Alright? No grades, and curriculum became very loose and very trendy current topics, which we still see today. So whatever was relevant at the time, that was, essentialism then said, in reaction to what Dewey was doing, they said, wait a minute, surely some things that we know in the past still are relevant today. Isn't there some of our experience that carries over? And so the essentialist said, let's look at what is useful. Okay, so notice they had bought into the idea, and perhaps Darwin and Marx and Hegel, some of these were behind all this, but they bought into the idea that there's constant evolving. So some things in the past probably weren't very useful, but some things are. Some things are relevant, and we can use both. All right, so they were trying to form some kind of compromise. I'm being very general and broad in my explanations here. Already starting with Rousseau back in 1800s and in 1800s, Rousseau in France began talking about individual meaning and how the person was much more important than a body of knowledge or learning, and the individual became much more important. And the goal here in this philosophy of education is personal meaning and freedom. And so you may have heard things like values clarification, meism, I'm more important than anyone else. What I'm experiencing and thinking and feeling and doing is much more important. That was existentialism. Well, we also have behaviorism. You may have heard of B.F. Skinner. I believe died in the last, I'm going to say, 8 years. Born in 1904, but taught at Harvard for years. But he espoused behaviorism, and what he talked about was that we can, how many of you heard of Pavlov's dog? You know, where he rang the bell and then put food in the cage? And so when the bell rang, the dog's mouth began watering, that's your physiology. When the bell rang, the meat came in the cage. Eventually, he got the place where he could make the dog's mouth water without it being in the cage, because the bell was going. And so he said that by providing a certain stimulus, the bell, you can create certain responses that normally would not have been there. Well, Skinner took that idea and turned it around and said that if you do something long enough, you can create certain stimuli. He just reversed it. And so he began to say that we can teach toward certain behaviors. And so we had an education then, as that infiltrated the educational world, we began talking about behavioral objectives. And instead of saying, at the end of this course, you're going to know something about Roman history, the behavioral objective would be, at the end of this course, you'll be able to write, something out of the air here, three paragraphs within 5 minutes' time on the importance of Julius Caesar while the teacher is watching.
Okay.
That's behavioral thinking. You begin to see behaviors. So you teach so that certain behaviors come about. And we talk about certain skills. We teach so that certain skills are in place. And we teach in a programmed way. Now, I want you to keep that in mind. Let me shift gears a little bit and just review this in another way. Remember I said in the 1920s we had progressivism, we had Dewey. In the 1930s and 40s we had essentialism. World War II, with its big push for marshal the population for the production during World War II. In other words, we wanted to teach in such a way that children could go out and be productive members of society, work in industry. Industry was a big thing. So we had teachers as supervisors. We had principals and superintendents as departmental heads. They had a very business-like structure in that time. Again, playing off of the essentialism, what's useful, what's practical. But then in the 60s and 70s, we had a big reaction to what was going on in the 1950s, and we called it the upheaval of the 60s with all the student riots and the and Vietnam War and all those things. People became disillusioned with the larger institutions in society. Government, church, school, anti-establishment was the big thing. And so existentialism, values clarification, meism came to be the fore, and we had open classrooms where the teacher rarely addressed the whole class, but the classroom would have little corners or tables with all kinds of educational activities available in those on those tables. So maybe in one corner you would have all kinds of building type things that would help students work with their hands and build things. Perhaps in the corner you have tape recorders. They could listen to tapes, maybe film strips. They could look at all different kinds of things. Explore their world, open classroom. The teacher would come along and would just guide the students' learning, but wouldn't structure heavily. Again, you see the influence of Dewey's experiential doing sort of thing, combined with existentialism, where the student is more important. And the establishment, government, society, some of the other things aren't as important. But I want you to notice, now this is where I want to connect it to where you and I are. ACE began, I'm not sure what the date was, for accelerated Christian education, but it began, I'm going to say, you know, Edward, 1973?
Early
70s. How many of you have taken some form of individual CLE, ACE, BC? How many of you have taken some form? A lot of you have. That is a takeoff from a couple of things. The open classrooms, the program instruction that B.F. Skinner talked about. We saw a lot of textbooks come out, and Saxon Math would buy a little bit of this in that you begin with something you know and move towards something you don't know. All right? And so you have program instruction. If you took individualized pace in ACE, for instance, you would have, you read a paragraph, answer a few questions, read a few paragraphs, answer a few questions, math, look at an example, study it, and then you begin to do it. And it leads you step by step. And the idea is you don't need a teacher the whole time up there lecturing. Well, he just comes around and helps. It helps you along. In fact, he's not even called a teacher, he's called a supervisor. Alright? You see how they began to borrow some ideas from the open classroom? Even progressivism would say the teacher as facilitator, not as the one who tells from me up here to you down here. We kind of learn together and I walk along beside. All those things now have been used in an individualized classroom. And it comes out of a lot of this century, a lot of those ideas being incorporated. And Dewey's influence is still felt today And Christian education is not immune from it. That's my point that I want you to catch. You're using some of Dewey's ideas. And then, of course, the 80s and 90s, we've seen a big push for back to basics. And I think ACE was part of that push. I remember going to ACE conventions as a high schooler and hearing Dr. Howard talk about things like the pendulum swing back, you know, and all this upheaval in the 1960s. This is the late 70s, early 80s when I was hearing this, how that we're now moving away from all this no grades and no objective standards, you know, the fact that some people don't need anymore. Moving away from that, he said the pendulum is swinging back. And it has in many ways been swinging back. And we hear a lot about back to basics. We hear about Goals 2000. I haven't read up on that the last couple of years and haven't kept up with that. I do know that much of that sounds good, but it's not. How's that for definition?
I'd like to read just a few comments now and just help us sort of put all this back together. Let me read what the Encyclopedia Britannica had to say about progressive education. Although the name progressive education has fallen somewhat into disrepute since the 1950s, the notions it expressed have had deep influence on public school systems everywhere. Activity programs, imaginative writing, projects, field trips, movable desks, and space in every classroom for dramatics and informal activities are found in almost all school systems. The grading system has been done away with in many schools, and the results of individual research are often pooled and reported to the class. Again, the emphasis on society, not the individual. Values clarification championed individual again, but progressive education championed the group, society. Children are given more responsibility for the social life of their school and so are practiced in citizenship as they never were before. And these developments are common in varying degree all over the world. If you ever get a chance to read the book, Seven Men Who Rule the World from the Grave, John Dewey is one of them. I'd like to read another article, just a summary, that was in the March-April issue of American Enterprise. Excuse me. Entitled, Why Traditional Education is Progressive. Catch the paradox in the title. For much of this century, two alternate visions of what constitutes the best way to educate children have been competing with one another. Traditional education has emphasized rote learning. Now, just how much of this is in your school? Rote learning, especially if you use a BECA, you're going to have a lot of rote learning. Phonics, memorization of historical facts, and classrooms where students all studied the same text at the same time. Progressive educational theorists, however, have dismissed such methods because they believe they fail to develop critical thinking skills. Dewey wanted to not teach you what to think, he wanted to teach you how to think. That's what critical thinking is all about. Or so say some. They believe that the traditional educational system locks those who are underprivileged or marginalized out of true participation in the culture. Progressive education has thus championed curriculum which, quote, would celebrate the culture of the oppressed and instruct in new methods that would encourage intellectual resistance. Let me comment on that. The whole idea of multiculturalism in recent years, and you know, the whole idea that you should teach Hispanics one thing in one way, you should teach African Americans or blacks in another way, their subject content should differ, and the kinds of tests you give them should be made for them and not the same for them as it is for for Caucasians or whites. They wanted to encourage intellectual resistance. That's the whole argument behind a lot of these things. But let's read on here now and see what he has to say. History is showing, however, that those nations which have chosen to use traditional methods of teaching have more effectively created social equality and elevated the lower classes of society. Progressive education methods, which dominate the United States, have not succeeded in creating increased social and economic equality among the underprivileged class. His point is that look at our urban centers. Look at the poor communities. Have those people been given the same opportunities to move up out of their conditions, like Booker T. Washington and dozens of other people we could mention who have grown up in incredible poverty, but because of what they learned, were able to move out of that class of people? Well, progressive education uses such words as modern, hands-on, developmentally appropriate, integrated, individualized, to describe the kind of education it seeks to provide students. Well, he says the results are that we have hastened the decline of literacy across the board. And it is true now that the United States has a lower literacy rate than some less developed countries, or at least other European countries. Hands-on education has come at the expense of written and verbal skills. Developmentally appropriate curricula assume that children are not able to digest large amounts of knowledge and facts about a given topic, and so on. So they go on to say that integrated education has sought to eradicate emphasis on one particular subject in favor of thematic or project-oriented teaching. Now, let me just say that a lot of those things can be good. How many of you find your students like a good field trip? Is it educational? Can be. A lot of other things we could talk about that we've been hearing criticized in here can be good things. But I'd like to point out that it's the philosophy behind them that makes all the difference. Now, again, remember that I believe that all truth is God's truth. Whether Dewey espoused it better than some Christian did or not, if it's true to human nature, it's true because God created human nature. And so, if we believe certain things to be true about the students, such as without the transforming power of Jesus Christ, we are given to evil, and it's deceptive, Jeremiah says. Who can know it? If we believe that God is the ultimate reality and that Scripture contains and is truth and that we teach it as such, then we're going to modify the things that we use, the field trips, the little projects, how much we allow the student to guide his own learning. We're going to say, wait a minute, there's some ways, some things that you're going to tend toward are not right. And so we begin to use what is best. Does that sound pragmatic? Use what is best in light of what we believe to be true and what God says about what is true. And thus, some modern Christian educators today have said that if you really want to be an effective teacher, learn all you can about the nature of the individual and the person. And then take what you know to be true about God and the world and the Bible and apply it to what that book says about what is true about human beings. A lot of fantastic ideas have come along down through the centuries about how people are made, how we think. A lot of outlandish and rather humorous if you read up on them. The fact remains that some things never change. And Milo started with this verse and I wanted to close with it. And so I think it's very appropriate to sandwich what we've said with this verse, Colossians 2:3. Christ in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. I don't believe I have begun to mine the depths of what that verse really means. Do I really believe that in Jesus Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge? I begin to ask then, so I teach science. What does Jesus Christ have to do with science? Is too much science a bad thing? Is too much math a bad thing? Is too much history a bad thing? If Jesus Christ created the world and science is simply a discovery of what he created, can you get too much science? Can you get too much math? In him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Just close the statement. Before I say that, let me just say one other thing. One of the things you want to keep in mind about education is that historically it has been the unfortunate victim of a dozen and one fads. I mean, in one decade we do one thing, in another decade we do another. Just take, for instance, now, I'm just curious what's going to happen with the current push toward consolidation. Is your community leaving the small schools and building big ones? How many of you see that happening? Leaving the smaller branches, public schools, and building one big mammoth facility. Yeah. My community is. And they're selling off all these small, still great condition schools. And my question is, what are they going to do in 10 years when they decide that, you know, there's just too many things about these buildings that aren't right? Let's go back to the small ones. What's going to happen? It wouldn't surprise me at all. But it's that kind of up and down and back and around and tossing about that has characterized much of education. And what does it reflect? It reflects man's attempt to describe reality and himself and the world outside of God. That's really what it reflects. Please don't be arrogant in what you're doing and in what you're teaching and in what you know. I believe that great minds throughout history have wrestled honestly and capably with the real questions of life. They've just come to the wrong conclusions because they failed to consider, have refused to consider that God is the ultimate reality. But we, you and I, have much to learn, and we can improve a lot. So a parent asked me one time, he said, isn't our school much better than public school? And he mentioned the school down the road, around the corner.
She talked to him the other day.
And how would you answer?
That's great. Well, I know he'll tickle. He's probably tickled pink.
Is that coming through the sound system? Picking up some trucker's CV or something. Schools are, in many ways, certainly spiritually, we are much improved, shall we say, superior, transformed would be the better word, by the power of God. Academically, if you compare us to the average American student, we are probably at least equal, if not better. And certainly if you go to urban centers, we are far and away much better. My concern is that we don't become arrogant in what we've been able to accomplish and that we seek to find out what it really means to believe that in Jesus Christ are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. I just want to repeat what John Martin said Tuesday night. He said, Jesus Christ proved beyond dispute. That's a bold statement in today's world. Beyond dispute, that some things will never change.
Okay, I wonder, does anyone have any questions? He's still up here.
Yes. You mentioned that I believe that Christian Christian day schools are at least equal or ahead of urban centers. To what do you attribute that?
Well, on a purely academic level, I would. Some of you, yeah. Had you, okay. He said that, well, I mentioned that our schools were at least as good or better than the average public school student, or our students would be, you know, as good or better. And to what would I attribute that? Some of you in the audience can enlarge on what I say or correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say on the academic side, just because we have maintained some sense of stability and direction, we haven't done too much jumping back and forth. Spiritually, of course, I would say the roots of that are because we believe in absolutes. Some things don't change. And that virtue, character, is foundational to everything else. And that knowledge is not the route to virtue, but that Jesus Christ is the route to that. Anyone else?
In that list you made under rote learning, science was included.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more likely to be more rote than science?
Yeah, I see your point. Whole language mean that you learn to sight read, I mean words, memorize the word itself rather than sounds.
Yeah, that casts a negative thing there on
why. Yeah. I don't, well, if it did, I didn't read it right. I was picking and choosing out of that article. I don't think it was totally critical of that. It just was trying to characterized the traditional and progressive, and then it tried to show how the two have come together somewhat. All right, thank you for your attention.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.